Rome, around 500 B.C., had a king, Tarquin or whatever, but he raped a girl named Lucretia. And the girl got so upset, she got the Roman leaders together, and she commits suicide right in front of them. They get upset and kill the king. And then they make a rule that if anybody in Rome would ever declare themselves king, anybody could kill that person without any repercussions. So for 500 years, no one in Rome wanted to come anywhere close to being called a king because they knew that anybody could kill them. Publius was one of the original founders of the Roman Republic. Publius was building a mansion, and when the rumor went around he was thinking of being king, when he heard the rumor, he destroyed his own mansion. So Rome was a republic, a res publica. What's the difference between a republic and a democracy? In a democracy, you every day have to personally be in the marketplace to talk politics. And if you don't keep up with politics every day, you're called an idiotus. And it only worked with you personally being there, because if you got into the suburbs, you couldn't go down there every day. You would have to depend on somebody telling you what's being talked about, and they could flavor it one way or the other. And then when you would give them your decision to take back, they could flavor your response one way or the other. And so whoever controls the media and communication ends up controlling the democracy. So a democracy, when it gets larger than you personally being there present every day, it breaks down. That was a democracy. A republic is you take care of your family and your farm, and you have someone in your place that goes down to the market every day and keeps up with politics. That person is your res publica, in the place of. And so a representative form of government, the REP in the word representative, is the same REP in the word republic. So a republican form of government is a representative form of government, so you can take care of your family and farm. Now, in Rome, the representatives were not elected. They were hereditary, back to the families of the original founders of the Roman Republic. So those guys that killed that king and set up the Republic, it was their families and descendants that were the quote-unquote representatives. And so in America, we did a little of a hybrid, where we mixed a little bit of the Athens in, where we democratically elect our representatives. And so in Rome, they had about 600 representatives called senators, and they would meet and discuss and make the decisions. And things were going along fine. They kept every now and then they were attacked, and they would give somebody a concentrated power of being a temporary dictator for a year, and then when the attack was defeated, the person would go back to their farm. A famous guy named Cincinnatus did that. But as time went on, these 600 senators got more wealthy, and they ended up becoming an aristocracy, and the people got in debt, and the senators sort of fell into parties. You know, instead of Republican, Democrat, or whatever, it was one party was led by a guy named Pompey. He was a military hero that fought in North Africa, Spain, and in the Holy Land. Pompey actually conquered Israel. He actually went into the Holy of Holies of the Jewish temple, and he came back out and told his soldiers, don't touch this place. And so the Jews liked Pompey. there was another leader of a party in Rome named Crassus. He was the richest guy in Rome, sort of a George Soros type. I mean, he was like super, super wealthy. Matter of fact, Crassus made his money with fire brigades. Sounds nice enough. Well, it's different. Your house would suspiciously catch on fire, and Crassus's fire brigade, young men with buckets of water, would all of a sudden show up and be there, and Crassus would show up, and he would offer to buy your mansion for pennies on the dollar. And the longer you negotiated, the more the house burnt and the less he offered. And so Crassus ended up becoming the richest landowner in Rome. And so we had this, and then the third party was led by Caesar. Caesar was from a family that was aristocratic but had gone bankrupt because his dad got on the outs with a former leader. And so Caesar had to join the military to escape debt collectors. Turns out he was a great general, brought back lots of booty and slaves into Rome and would give them out to the people. And so the people liked Caesar because he's giving out slaves and stuff to them for free. Caesar gets involved in politics, and he's actually married to the daughter of Pompey. And so we got this triumvirate of Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus. Now Crassus, the rich guy, dies in 53 BC. So it turns into a tug of war between Caesar and Pompey. And since Pompey is the rich establishment candidate, and he wants to preserve the republic, yes, the rich are rich, and yes, the poor are in debt, but it's better than a king, so let's just have the status quo. Caesar, though, he wants to increase power, but he doesn't have any money. And so what does he do? Caesar raids the federal treasury, Temple of Saturn in Rome, where they had 400 years of Roman gold. He robs the money, and he uses the money to buy supporters against Pompey. He said, use money to get men, use men to get money. This is like using, you know, stimulus dollars to buy Acorn and SEIU supporters to campaign against your Republican establishment opponent, you know. Caesar finally defeats Pompey. Pompey had his head chopped off. And does Caesar now say, okay, people, you helped me get here. You can help me run Rome? No, forget it. He makes himself dictator for life. He starts the cult of Julius Caesar and makes Mark Antony his high priest. He makes himself a god. He even changed the calendar. I mean, he's building all these things in Rome. The calendar in Rome used to, this is a little trivia side note here, the calendar began March 1st, and all ancient calendars began March 1st. That was the beginning of spring. And we know that because our seventh month was September. Sept was Latin for seven. Oct, like October, octagon, oct was Latin for eight. Nov was Latin for nine. And December, decimal, was Latin for 10. But Caesar moved the beginning of the year from March 1st to January 1st. And then he took the old fifth month and he named it after himself. It used to be Quintilius, but he changed it to July. And it only had 30 days, so he took a day from the old end of the year, February, and he added it to July. Now, the next emperor was his nephew, Augustus Caesar. He decided to name a month after himself, which he did, August. It only had 30 days, so he took a day from the old end of the year, February, added it to August. So that's why July and August have 31 days, and February has only 28. If they would have kept that up, we wouldn't have had any February left, you know. But it shows that these people were so powerful. And so Caesar consolidates power. Sadly enough, the senators thought, if we can just kill Caesar, we can save the Republic. And so they surround him on the Ides of March, March 15th, and they stab him to death. But the people riot. They loved Caesar because he gave them free stuff. And so they turned into these riots in Rome, and finally Augustus Caesar took over, and he was a total dictator. Augustus Caesar owned everybody, everything, every life, and he decided to take a world census. Sort of the NSA type thing, and ironically enough, that census is what required Joseph and Mary to go to Bethlehem to be counted, where Jesus was born, which was the fulfillment of the Jewish prophecies where the Messiah would come from. But nevertheless, the Roman Republic ended, and they got their emperor, their dictator. And so we've seen, out of most of history, you have kings. We have these rare instances of Israel, and then the rubber band snaps back into the hands of a king. We have Athens, and the people ruled, and then they had chaos, and the rubber band snapped back, and they had a king. You had Rome, where it was a republic, and the power was separated, but after time, Caesar found a way to usurp power and make himself dictator, and the rubber band snapped back. And as you go through history, there are some Italian city-states until Napoleon finally conquers them. Some Swiss cantons up in the mountains that nobody could reach. There was some free cities in Germany that were sort of underneath of the Holy Roman Emperor, but, you know, he was too busy with other things, so they sort of had a little freedom. There was the seven United Netherlands, which was seven provinces that sort of worked together as a republic until Napoleon conquered them. There was an Icelandic Commonwealth from around 900 to 1200. And they had different tribes and different judges and no king until finally the king of Norway conquered them. There was a Russian republic called Novgorod. And for 400 years, it was powerful on the North Sea until Ivan the Terrible killed 60,000 of them and incorporated Novgorod into the Empire of Russia. And then finally you come up to England, and they had their kings, King Henry, King James, but then they had King Charles the First. And there was a war with the Puritans, and Oliver Cromwell won. They chopped off Charles the First's head. And for 15 years in England, they did not have a king. It was called, you know, the Parliament and the Commonwealth, and, you know, it wasn't a total republic. It was sort of a confusing thing, but it certainly was not a king. After that, they got Charles the Second back. And the people in England said, you know, maybe a king thing is not divinely appointed. Maybe it's just the only thing that we're used to. Because we did go for 15 years without a king, and we sort of survived. And so from that point on, the Parliament in England began to say, well, maybe we don't have to just give in. And then here, but after Charles II, you get James II. He's the James who was the Duke of York that New York City is named after. So New York is this Duke of York, which is James II. He decided to be Catholic. The people of England wanted to be Protestant. And so they bring his daughter and her husband over from Holland. And the daughter was Mary, and her husband was William. And so this is William and Mary. And they come over, and they rule England. This was a clear case of the Parliament choosing the monarchs. So instead of it being, oh, this is God-ordained monarchs, and this is, you know, this is a supernatural system set up, the Parliament says, we're the ones that chose them. And so you had began to have this battle in England of, was the king, divine right of kings, you know, chosen by God, or is it just the only thing we're used to? But then finally, biggest change in world history was America. The different colonies that were started were 3,000 miles away from the king, and Europe was the big chessboard. America was sort of the outback. And so the kings basically said, run your own colony, just don't bother me, and every now and then send a boatload of, you know, tobacco over or something like that. And so the people in America had a century and a half of practicing self-rule based on internal morality. The King of England was Anglican. Every colony, is this boring? Hopefully I'm not losing anyone.
No, we're good. This is a great history lesson, Bill.
I read through every charter of every colony, and believe it or not, every colony was started by a different Christian denomination. A little background, if I can go on another rabbit trail here, Europe was Catholic, and then Martin Luther starts the Reformation in 1517, and then the Muslims surround Vienna, Austria in 1529. 100,000 Muslims under Suleiman the Magnificent surrounded Vienna, Austria. They controlled the entire Mediterranean. And, of course, they had Spain for 700 years. They had Sicily, Corsica, Sardinia. They had conquered all of North Africa, all the Middle East. The Holy Roman Emperor, the most powerful Catholic monarch in the world, was Charles V of Spain. He had Spain, he had Portugal, he had Italy, he had the Spanish Netherlands. He had, you know, control as the Holy Roman Emperor of all these German kingdoms, and then he had all the New World and even the Philippines. And so the sun never set on the Spanish Empire. And so we had the two big world empires was the Spanish Holy Roman Empire and the Muslim Ottoman Empire. And so Charles V sees that Vienna, Austria is surrounded by these Muslim Ottomans. And so he decides he's going to make a deal with the Lutheran princes, and it's called the Peace of Augsburg of 1555. And this Peace of Augsburg of 1555 had a little Latin phrase that made a big difference. The phrase was, curios regio, ius religio, which means whose is the reign, his is the religion. This basically said, okay, king, believe what you want in your kingdom. Let's just work together against these Muslims that are invading Europe. And so this Peace of Augsburg started a domino effect across Europe, where different kings decided to believe things that were a little different. So England became Anglican. Holland became Dutch Reformed. Northern Germany and Sweden became Lutheran. Switzerland became Calvinist. Scotland became Presbyterian. Greece was Greek Orthodox. Russia was Russian Orthodox. And Italy, Spain, France, Austria, Poland remained Roman Catholic. And if you did not believe the way your king did, you were persecuted and you fled. And so in the 1600s, there was this mass migration of people shifting around Europe simply for conscience sake. And those were the ones that spilled over and founded colonies in America. And so every colony was started by a different denomination. Virginia was Anglican Christian. Massachusetts was Puritan Christian. Rhode Island was Baptist Christian. New York was Dutch Reformed Christian. Delaware and New Jersey were originally Swedish Lutherans. And Maryland was Catholic. And Connecticut and New Hampshire were Congregationalist Christians. And Pennsylvania was Quaker. And you could go on. And guess what? They did not get along. And they would chase each other out of each other's colonies, sort of like what was happening in Europe. But then when the revolution started, they all had to work together to fight the King of England. After the revolution, their attitude was, we may not agree on religion all the time, but you are willing to fight and die for my freedom. I need to let you practice your faith. this began the idea of tolerance. Now, they wanted to make sure the federal government would not follow the pattern of Europe and pick one Christian denomination and make it the national one. And so they passed the First Amendment that says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And so who's limited by this? The Congress. And they shall do what? They shall not make a law respecting. What does respecting mean? It means concerning, neither for nor against. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Not the acknowledgement of God. We're talking an establishment of mandatory taxes, mandatory membership. You know, you couldn't hold office unless you were a member. And then they topped it off by saying, and Congress shall not prohibit the free exercise of religion. And so religion was under states' jurisdiction. Sort of like today, some states have gay marriage and others don't. Some states have smoking bans and others don't. Some states, have minors drink alcohol and others don't. Some states have gambling and others don't. Back then, some states gave a little more religious freedom and some states didn't. But it was up to the people in the states to decide what they wanted. And so like a racetrack with 13 lanes, you had out in front Rhode Island and Pennsylvania and Maryland, and way in the back you had Connecticut, Massachusetts, and South Carolina. I mean, you read these constitutions between 1776 and 1790, nine state constitutions required you to be a Protestant Christian to hold state office. South Carolina said that the Christian Protestant religion is hereby deemed the established religion of the state. North Carolina, the same. A couple states were a little liberal. Maryland said all you had to do was be a Christian, which means you could be Protestant or Catholic. Delaware said all you had to do was believe in the Trinity. Pennsylvania was real liberal. Ben Franklin signed that constitution. That said all you had to do was believe in the divine inspiration of the Old and New Testament to hold state office. In other words, you not only had to lay your hand on a Bible, you had to swear you believed in the Bible. And the most liberal state was the most evangelical, Rhode Island, founded by Baptists. They had zero religious requirements to hold state office. They said if you required someone to be a Christian, they could say they were, even if they weren't, just to get elected. And that would be hypocritical. I mean, could you imagine someone actually saying they're Christian just to get elected? Well, that's sort of hard to imagine. But anyway, so this was the situation in America. 98% Protestant. Only three colonies had let Catholics in. They were Pennsylvania, Maryland, and New York. And there's only 20,000 Catholics in a country of 3 million people. Only seven synagogues in the whole country. 1,500 Jews. It was a predominantly Protestant country. Then there was an Irish potato famine in 1846, and millions of Irish Catholics came to America. After some backlash, they finally got tolerated. Then there was a persecution of Jews in Bavaria, and then they came across. And so you drop a pebble in the pond, the ripples go out. First, there was tolerance for the denomination that started the colony. Then it went out to Protestants. Then it went out to Catholics. Then it went out to Jews and monotheists. Finally went out to the atheists, and ironically enough, the last ones to be tolerated are kicking the first ones out. So in a weird sense, everybody's tolerated in America except the Christians that founded the country.
Well, Bill, anyway. You certainly make history come alive with
your
passion.
Yes, you do. That was a whirlwind tour through history.
We're exhausted, but it was wonderful. Such great lessons from history.
Marvelous.
But I was just wanting to know, as we head towards conclusion here, what are your observations on America today? Have we learned from the history lessons of the past?
Well, a way of explaining GMO, genetically modified, seeds. We're familiar with that idea, that term.
Yes.
And what America politically did was a GMO, that we genetically engineered a form of government where we have a little bit from the Jews, the idea of rights from a creator and equality, a little bit from Athens, the idea of electing democratically, a little bit from Rome where you have representatives, a little bit from England where they have a constitution, that limited the power of the government. And we mixed it all together and we got this democratically elected constitutional republic. It's this really good genetically modified seed. Now, question, what do you do with it? Well, you plant it in soil. And we've taken this seed and we planted it in Afghanistan or in Egypt. And lo and behold, in one election cycle, they get taken over by the Muslim Brotherhood. They institute Sharia law, and it's the death penalty for someone to leave Islam. And women are treated as second-class citizens. And we're scratching our heads thinking, how come we planted the seed and it didn't produce the same harvest that it did over here? And then when the Soviet Union fell down 20 years ago and we helped them set up republics, and 20 years has gone by, and now we're finding out that basically the same people are in charge and it's run by gangs and sort of like a mob, the mafia type of organizations. And we're scratching our heads thinking, how come that seed didn't have the same harvest? Well, you look at it, in America, that seed was planted in a 98% Protestant country, 2% Catholic and a tenth of a percent Jewish, but in a sense it was 100% Judeo-Christian. And so it was a populace that was schooled in morality and virtue and self-control because of the idea that there is a deity that is watching you, that wants you to be nice to people, and he's going to hold you eternally accountable. So even if there's no police around, you have this thing called a conscience that wants you to do what's right and nice. If there is no concept of a God, then this life is all there is. And if you can do something that's wrong, but it'll benefit you and no one will find out, well, you'd be a fool not to do it. And so we see that the same way that in Israel it was dependent on the priests teaching them the law, the same way in Athens, where as long as they had morality, virtue, you know, Plato says that they could have their democratic freedoms. You know, in Rome, as long as they had power separated, you know, they had the people had a voice. But we see that in America, as long as the populace had basic morality, it could have freedom. But as we give up on that, there's more crime, there's more killing, there's more students killing each other, there's more gun violence, and our response is, government, do something about it. And the only thing the government knows how to do is to take away freedoms. Okay, we're going to take away your freedom of press, take away your freedom of rights to possess and bear arms, take away your freedom here and there and the other. And, you know, before you know it, yeah, it'll be secure, but you won't have any freedom left. And Ben Franklin said, whoever trades freedom for security will get neither. So our government, a good quote from John Adams, he said, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the government of any other. It's like a parent that gives the teenager the car keys and says, you can come back home whenever you want because I know you're going to do what's right because you have internal morals. But if you don't do it right, and you drink and drive and party, and you're going to be pulled over by the police and thrown in jail, and you're going to be controlled behind bars and in handcuffs. As a teenager, you're going to be controlled either voluntarily from the inside or forcibly from the outside. It's the same way with a nation. We're either going to be voluntarily controlled with the virtues and morality, or we're going to give in to our passions and lusts, and there's going to be crime, and we're going to say, government, step in, and the government's more than happy to, but every new law that is passed is another bar that comes down on our cage, taking away some more of our freedom. So we see this trend in America of power concentrating, and that rubber band is snapping back into the hands of fewer and fewer people, and that is something that George Washington warned of in his farewell address, where he said, disorders and miseries will incline the minds of men to seek security in the absolute power of an individual, mm-hmm. who will turn this disposition to his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty, and thus, whatever form of government you call it, it'll be a despotism. So Washington says, okay, he felt the pull of the rubber band back toward a king, you know, everybody's used to that, and he says, there's going to be crisis, there's going to be disorders and miseries, and everybody's going to want a quick fix, and somebody's going to offer to fix it if you give up a little bit of your freedoms, and so the power's going to get concentrated, and then you're going to wind up with a despot again. So that was his very first, or that was George Washington's farewell address, and it's sort of something that we can remember today.
Bill, what final words would you have for our listeners in regard to what you've just outlined for us and where we are today? What would you like to say to people?
Well, our founders sacrificed their prosperity for their posterity. They mm-hmm. pledged their lives and their fortunes and their sacred honor for a generation yet unborn. Even the Constitution says to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Today, we're sacrificing our posterity for prosperity. We're saddling our kids with an unpayable debt to try to maintain our standard of living. So we've basically switched. And so there's a proverb that says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. And when I think of what inheritance our kids are getting right now, it sort of motivates me to say, well, we need to be involved to try to pass on to our kids a country with as many freedoms and as opportunities as what we inherited. And will we succeed? Well, it's at least worth trying. That's where I stand.
Thank you. Well spoken. We really appreciate you being here with us today.
Are there any new books or projects in the works before we go?
Well, I do send out a daily email. It's called American Minute. People can sign up at AmericanMinute.com. Something that happened on each date in history. It's free. I also do a TV show called Faith in History, and it airs on DirecTV on the TCT network. And you can also watch a lot of shows on my website. Just go to AmericanMinute.com and click on the link to watch the Faith in History show. And then another book where it's called Miracles in American History. So it's 32 times in America's past when there's been crises that have looked insurmountable. You know, the British, the War of 1812, you know, World War II, a cholera epidemic in 1849 when 150,000 Americans died. And we had leaders that called us to pray and people with faith and courage that rose up and things turned around. So it's called Miracles in American History. And that's another book that just finished that we're excited about.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you again so much for spending so much time with us. We appreciate it. Everyone, you've been listening to William Federer, author, historian, noted American. Thank you so much, Bill, for being with us.
Thank you. Anytime.